Professor Snyder, let's start with things which are happening now. What do you think Vladimir Putin and Russia can achieve in Syria? Could we say that Russia is helping there?
Well, this is fine. I have no special insight into what Vladimir Putin is thinking, but I tend to think that when we consider Russian foreign policy, we should always start with the Russian domestic situation. Russia is a very unusual political society in that, first of all, most of the news still comes through television, and second of all, the television only concentrates on foreign affairs, which means that for Russian politics to function, there has to be a steady production of international news, which can in some way reflect favorably on the president. So my own sense of what is happening is that, having essentially lost in Ukraine, the Russian leadership, rather than acknowledging that it's lost in Ukraine, which is impossible, which is unthinkable, they cannot acknowledge that, they have changed the subject. If you watch Russian television, what you notice is that they've shifted literally from one day to the next, about a week ago, talking about the defense of the brothers in Ukraine to the wonderful defense of the Syrian people. Is this going to help Syria? I mean, there one just has to look at Russian foreign policy doctrine. They're not concerned about people. They're concerned about the defense of autocratic structures, and they're quite open about that. So any threat to autocratic structures, whether it's Islamic terrorism or civil society or student protesters, it's all the same thing. So one can expect the Russians to attack all opponents to the current autocratic regime in Syria, which means more deaths and more refugees coming to the Czech Republic.
Could the development in Syria with the Russian engagement now in any way endanger the European Union, apart from the flow of refugees?
Well, it's a good question, because for Russia, the most important thing after domestic public opinion is the European Union. The European Union is the main enemy of Russian foreign policy, because the European Union provides examples of how countries can be both richer and freer than Russia. And that includes post-communist countries and even post-Soviet countries. And that is, of course, why Ukraine is so sensitive. Because if Ukraine were to grow closer to Europe, it would provide an example for the Russian people, and that would be unbearable for the current Russian leadership. So whatever Russia does around the world, the first thing to check is domestic public opinion, and the second thing to check is Europe. I'm not sure. My sense is that Russia has been, one of Russia's interests in Syria so far has been to help Assad produce large numbers of refugees, because refugees tend to push European politics to the right. And if European politics gets pushed to the right, that helps the national populists who are opposed to European Union. And since Russian policy is to bring down the European Union, that may be what they're thinking about. It's hard for me to see how it could help the European Union, but maybe I'm missing something.
Did I understand you right that Putin, in fact, gave up on the situation in Ukraine and changed his orientation towards Syria?
No, I wouldn't say that he gave up. I would say that he doesn't have any good news to offer the Russian people at the moment. So they were very euphoric about invading and annexing Crimea. And then for a while, there was a good deal of enthusiasm about the rebellion in the Donbass, which of course was supported by Russian weapons and Russian soldiers. But there's not a lot of good news coming from the Donbass. It's a complete disaster. The Russian intervention generated 2 million refugees. The economy of the Donbass is completely dead. There's no one coming back into Russia, including the fighters, who can say that things are going very well in Donbass. So what's happening is that they are going to freeze that conflict. They're going to look for other ways to hurt Ukraine, but they're shifting the story, because for a story, something has to happen. And in Ukraine, right now, nothing is happening. I'm not saying that Russia's given up on Ukraine. I think the basic idea is to destabilize the Ukrainian state so that the European Union can't enlarge. I don't think that will change. But the emphasis has now shifted to Syria.
I understand, but going, or let us focus on Ukraine now. You say that Putin will probably try to destabilize Ukraine, but it seems to me that if he shifted his concentration to other places, this may also look like an opportunity for the democratic forces in Ukraine. Isn't that so?
Well, they certainly think so. I mean, there's
but you
no,
don't.
No. I mean, of course, it's better for there not to be a war than for there to be a war. It's better for there to be a ceasefire than not to be a ceasefire. But for Ukrainians, for the Ukrainian government, the main problem is reforming the territory which is under Ukrainian control, which is the vast majority of the country. Whether there's a war, whether there's not a war, that's their main problem, and that's a big enough problem for them to handle. So, yeah, it's good for them that the fighting stop in many ways. But whether it's an opportunity depends upon the Ukrainian leadership. It's up to them to make the hard decisions.
I think I read somewhere that ex-president of Georgia, Saakashvili, who is now in charge of the Odessa region, if I'm not mistaken, said that the difference between Georgia and Ukraine is that in Ukraine there is quite a strong public opinion which is oriented towards Europe, while on the other hand in Georgia there is economic elite which is willing to support reforms, which you don't have in Ukraine. Do you think that's right?
I wouldn't want to comment on Georgia, but it's certainly true that in Ukraine, both public opinion polls and the activity of civil society point towards a European orientation. And it's worth remembering that this is what the whole conflict in Ukraine was about. It happened not It doesn't primarily have to do with Americans or Europeans or Russians. It has to do with Ukrainians who see Europe as a way to help them address their own internal domestic problems. Ukrainians, in the end of 2013, wanted an association agreement with the European Union because they quite correctly saw that as a way to improve the rule of law in their own country. That's where this revolution begins, with the desire of Ukrainians to have a more transparent, a more responsible governance of their own country. So certainly that's true. I mean, Europe is probably more popular in Ukraine now than it is almost anywhere else, including, you know, the European Union itself.
But you still don't think that Ukraine could become a member state of the European Union in the near future?
Well, not in the near future. The problems of corruption and the rule of law are too great. But I think the European Union should have the policy or the stance that we are open to all comers who can demonstrate that they can meet the basic standards of the rule of law and democracy and the acquis communautaire and so on. The job of Ukrainian political elites is not to talk about how they want to join the European Union. The job of Ukrainian political elites is to make their country the kind of place that the European Union would want to admit. And there is a huge amount of potential in Ukraine. You have an educated working class. You have agricultural resources. You have a lot of export potential. So there's no reason why, you know, in the long run, Ukraine couldn't join the European Union. And Ukrainians are perfectly aware that this is not a matter of tomorrow or next week or next year.
But in the long run, do you think that Moscow will ever permit that, to have a Ukrainian in the European Union?
I mean, in the long run, all kinds of things can happen. I mean, if you ask about Moscow in the long run, I wouldn't want to imagine that Moscow in the long run will be in the same place that Moscow is now. Russian policy changes, Russian foreign policy changes. Yeah, they talk now as though, you know, Crimea was always their destiny, but only 3 years ago, President Putin was denying that they had any interest in Crimea. They talk now as though China is their closest friend forever. I really wonder whether they'll be talking that way in 5 years or even in 1 year. Russia's basic geopolitical position is that they're stuck between the European Union and China. They seem now to have made the choice that they're trying to destroy Europe and move towards China. whether that will seem wise to Russians themselves in a year or 5 years or 10 years is an open question. So when you talk about the long run, I see it rather differently. I think in the long run, the question is not whether Russia will let Ukraine do this or that. In the long run, the question is whether Russian elites believe that their current strategy of becoming a satellite of China is the right strategy, or whether perhaps they themselves want to shift back towards the West. And if they shift back towards the West, then the Ukrainian question no longer exists.
I can understand that Vladimir Putin changes his political opinion. We were all witnessing that. But could Russia change its leader? I'm asking, can we imagine that Vladimir Putin would be peacefully replaced by somebody else? And can we... Can history help us in answering that question?
Well,
I mean, recent history.
It can't give us a specific answer, but I mean that what the problem that Russians face has nothing to do, has very little to do with Russian history. It's a general problem, and that is the politics of succession, of who the next ruler is going to be. One of the reasons that people like democracy is that for all of its flaws and for all of its sloppiness and for all of its imperfections, in a democratic regime, you at least know that something else is going to come. So if you don't like the current leadership, you know that something else is going to come eventually. And that changes the whole political climate. I think the basic source of a lot of the problems that Russia is bringing to the world is that they don't know what's going to come next. And no one can even talk about it. And so there's this myth of a kind of eternal, immortal ruler. But it's not even like a monarchy, because there is no Putin II, who can come after Putin number one. So they have this problem, which is they don't know who's going to rule. And I think a lot of what they do is they export this problem. So their foreign policy doctrine that we protect all dictators, I think that arises from their anxiety about politics at home. Because since there is no succession principle, and since President Putin himself gives no hints about when he might ever leave power, all that Russians can imagine is some kind of violent takeover, because that's all that's left, right? That's logically all that remains. So until Russian elites come up with some scenario of how they're going to transition from power, the imagination in Russia is always going to have to be about some kind of violent change in power. I think that's a very unhealthy situation.
Why can't Russia become a normal political country? I mean, a democracy like the ones you described a while ago. Are there reasons in history which can help us to explain that? Lack of democratic tradition?
I tend to be among the optimists who think that there are not actually long-term reasons why countries can't change their structures. So, I mean, if someone had said in 1850 that Russia was going to become communist, that would have sounded like madness. So I think we can assume that countries can move in different directions. Or if someone had said in 1970 that China was going to become capitalist and become, you know, in the future, the largest capitalist economy in the history of the world, I think people would have thought that was madness. So I tend to think that there are not long-term structural reasons which prevent any kind of development. That said, the last 25 years in Russia have created certain problems which have to do more with the rule of law than with democracy. I think if people in Russia believed in the rule of law, then democracy could follow. And in that sense, although, you know, the Russian leadership doesn't like to admit it, the Russian problem is basically the exact same as the Ukrainian problem. It's just that Ukraine found a different solution. Ukraine's solution was to have a very messy democracy, whereas the Russian solution was to have a kind of authoritarianism. And I think it's probably easier to move from messy democracy to better democracy, or to move from oligarchical pluralism to real pluralism, than it is to move from authoritarianism to democracy. But it was going to require some brilliant leadership, and not just tactically brilliant. I mean, in a way, Russia's problem is that they're tactically very good. But being tactically good means that you get yourself into deeper and deeper situations without realizing what you're doing. And with both foreign policy and domestic policy, it's a bit like this. Putin is very good at winning in the short term in foreign policy, but in doing so, he creates larger problems in the long run. And in domestic policy, it's a bit the same way. I mean, they're extremely good at staying in power, but how does that serve the long-term interests of Russia as a country? I mean, looking back 20 years in the future, 100 years in the future, the question is not going to be what Putin did in Syria. The question is going to be what Putin do to prepare for a stable and successful Russian state. And that question is open.
I understand. Would you say that Russia is a powerful country? And if yes, what's the source of its power? Mm. And how big it is?
Well, I mean, the main source of Russia's power is its ability to make other things fall apart. So that's their specialty. In absolute terms, they have measurable kinds of power. They have natural resources they can export. They have a big army. They have nuclear weapons. But more important, in their own strategic thinking, is relative power. So the European Union is obviously a much, much bigger economy than Russia. I mean, the Russian economy is about the size of the French economy. Russia exports as much as the Netherlands. If Russia joined the European Union, it would be a mid-sized member of the European Union. I mean, it would be large in terms of territory, and in terms of potential, it would be enormous. But in terms of its current economic size, it's about the size of France. So it would be like a mid to big-sized member of the European Union. But it wouldn't be out of scale, if you see what I mean. But what they do is, rather than thinking about the politics of integration, they think about the politics of disintegration. They try to make other things fall apart. And that's where their power comes from. Their power is that they're trying to make Europe and America fall apart. They go away from each other. They're trying to make the European Union fall apart. Even individual states like Ukraine, they try to make fall apart. And in that world, if they can manage to hold together, then they become relatively stronger. So the challenge of Russia to Europe is not mainly one, I think, of guns. It's mainly one of thoughts. Europe has real problems, and the question is whether Russia can use those problems to make Europe fall apart, or whether Europe recognizes these problems, recognizes them as a challenge, and responds to them by continuing the process of integration. I think that's an open question.
I know that you followed and explained the ways Russian propaganda machine works, if I may put it that way. Do you have an answer to the question why Russian propaganda uses so many internationally renowned persons, like artists, for example? Depardieu or Netrebko come to mind?
That's a question for Netrebko and Depardieu and not to me. I would emphasize instead that there are a number of courageous artists, as you say, inside Russia itself, who have chosen to be critical of the regime and of its war in Ukraine. But of course, it's not surprising. I mean, every time there's some kind of national adventure, there are plenty of people who are willing to support the regime in its national adventure. We can't really expect that all cultural elites are going to be wise people. Cultural elites can be very adaptable. Look at Galt, for example.
We are speaking here in Prague, and I'm happy to congratulate you to the prize today. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
But as we speak in Prague, what do you think about the international reputation of the Czech Republic today? What is it like?
Well, it depends on where you're looking. So let's say you read Komsomolskaya Pravda, right? Which I do. I'm a reader of Komsomolskaya Pravda. The reputation of the Czech Republic is pretty good in sort of the more populist right-wing Russian newspapers. If you read their websites, you know, things that President Zeman does are fairly high up. When the Czech worry about refugees is an item in Russian news. So from the point of view of Komsomolskaya Pravda, the reputation of the Czech Republic is pretty good. Now, if what you mean is the point of view of other members of the European Union, I think in general there is quite a concern that the Czechs are treating the refugee issue in entirely unreflective national terms rather than accepting it as a European problem with a European solution. And the risk, you know, the sort of the emotional risk, the moral risk that Czechs are taking is that they're pushing the French and the Germans into thinking, well, why have we shown solidarity with the Czechs if the Czechs, whenever there's a problem, immediately forget about us and treat it as though only they were the ones who were suffering? So there is, I mean, you shouldn't, as you know very well, there's a real problem now with the reputation of the Czech Republic and the European Union.
You are, after all, an American historian. I know that for the United States, the Czech Republic could never be a very important place, but still, there was a strong feeling of Czech orientation towards the United States. There was strong support of American foreign policy from the Czech side in the 1990s. And what happened with that? Is that all gone?
Well, I mean, a couple of things have happened. There's a problem on the American side, which is general and doesn't have to do with the Czechs in particular, and that is that we have taken Europe for granted. We've taken the European Union for granted as an entity. We've treated instead other parts of the world as being more critical, which is perhaps understandable, but we've lost a lot of our our closer connections with Europeans and European institutions. And I think that's our fault, and I think that's a mistake which has to be corrected. I think the United States should be much more present in Europe than it is, and it should be alert to the possibility that the European Union is not just a permanent entity that you can count on, but in fact a very different but nevertheless essentially friendly entity which requires a certain amount of attention and support. On the Czech side, I mean, you have this pattern, I wonder, you may disagree, but I think the pattern has been that European Union membership actually enables provincialism. So long as you're not in the European Union, then you have to think about how do the Europeans see us, how does the world see us. But ironically, European Union membership, a little bit like, you know, being in the Habsburg monarchy, it allows you this sense of being surrounded by something else and therefore not having to think about the larger world. So, I mean, there are still plenty of Czech intellectuals, very impressive ones, some of whom we're speaking today, who maintain very close ties with the United States, and that's very important. But I think as a society, one doesn't feel in the newspapers and the media anyway the same kind of connection to what's happening in the United States. And the United States is often presented as a kind of strange place where people make strange decisions, and you know, what are they really doing, as opposed to a kind of a society that we might be able to understand. You know, you correct me. You're in the media. Maybe I'm wrong.
This is your interview, so there is no place to correct you. But one last question: your latest book about the Holocaust appears in Czech just now. How satisfied have you been with the critical response to it?
Well, first of all, I mean, I'm very, very happy and gratified that the book is appearing in Czech. It's appearing more or less simultaneously in about 20 languages, which means that there's a very unusual discussion opportunity for an international discussion of the book, and that's really wonderful for me. The book is a fairly radical attempt at rethinking the Holocaust. It makes causal arguments having to do with ecology and having to do with the destruction of the state, which work pretty strongly against a lot of the dominant assumptions of how the Holocaust happened. So predictably, the book has aroused a great deal of discussion, many very enthusiastic responses. So an excerpt of the book appeared in The Guardian, and I think it was the most read article in that part of The Guardian, I think, ever. There was an article in The New York Times that I wrote, which was the most read article in The New York Times for 3 days. So there are parts of the argument which people certainly find interesting. But since I'm trying to change fundamentally the way we understand the Holocaust, naturally there's also a lot of controversy, and that's natural and that's good. Because without argumentation, without people paying attention, you never get to any kind of good conclusion.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for your time.
Sure.